Thank you, Brother Stetler, and it is a delight to see all of you here on this Saturday afternoon. And many of you have been here throughout the week, and we thank you very, very much for your faithfulness to attend. Just a few items that perhaps you would be interested in terms of resources. I'm not sure if they have any more copies of my friend Wally Thornton's book, Radical Righteousness, over there or not. But if they do, as it relates to the discussion that we're going to have today, this is a wonderful, wonderful read. Now, this is not going to read like Louis L'Amour. It's not going to read like your favorite Christian fiction author. This is pretty weighty stuff, but very, very, very important as we consider who we are and where we're going. A number of years ago, Brother Spiel published a collection of sermons from the IHC called Valiant for Truth, and there was also a volume called No Uncertain Sound. And if you get a chance to get a hold of those, I'm fairly confident they're out of print now, but if you get a chance to get a hold of one of those, it's a wonderful sampling of what ministry was like in a very, very critical era in the life of our church, the life of our understanding of what the message of holiness is all about. The names there that some of you will know and have heard, and painfully, there are names that some of you have only heard about. I am going to reference Brother Shmuel this afternoon, and if I had it to do over again, I would have some sound bites to bring so that you could hear his voice. And Daryl Lee said to me, I think I heard him once and I don't hardly remember it. And that makes me feel extremely old because I just can't imagine somebody not having heard the voice of Harold Smule when God was on him and he lifted the ram's horn and preached the year of Jubilee. These sermons are recorded as far as the written page in these books, and if you have a chance to get a hold of one of them, why, I encourage you to do it. A few years ago also, there was a book that, is Mavis here? There he is. Larry, you would enjoy this one. This has a lot of pictures in it. Profile of the IH Convention. The 1952-1987, and some of your pictures are in here. Some of you, do you remember the old choir at Huntington used to sing on the county steps out there? Well, some of you are, some of your pictures are in here. You're wearing funny clothes, but your pictures are in here. So, if you ever get a chance to pick up a copy of that, it's good nostalgia, and when you get old, why, that's kind of what old folks do. They kind of remember what used to be, but it also helps to explain who we are. We have begun a series of studies in the history of the holiness movement, and as I come to this session today, and I look over this crowd, I am reminded of what I endeavor to teach my ministerial students about the value of serious preaching. Brian Bailey thought I said serious preaching. Well, I mean that too, but serious preaching. That means that you know exactly where you're going, and from week to week, you're there, no matter who comes in or who doesn't come in. You know where you are. The Lord's put his thumb in your back. And you preach that message knowing that you have not chosen it. It simply has chosen you. And this afternoon, what I have to say may be a bit blunt and plain, and I face it quite frankly with a great deal of fear and trepidation. And I tell you that because I really do feel that way, and I tell you that because I want all the sympathy I can get. But I really do feel that way. Because what I've got to deal with today is an era of our movement that was a very troubled era. It was an era that is going to require us to deal with some very specific issues. And we can only understand, as a matter of fact, from the very first day that I have known that this assignment was mine, I have dreaded this day. Because we're going to have to deal with some issues that really define why we are here. And it may or may not be comfortable, but it will define some very traumatic moments in the life of the what we have come to know as the conservative holiness movement or the come out movement. And I'm not preaching. Please don't shoot the messenger. I just report the news. I'm going to do my very, very best to be as objective as possible. And I have no intentions of being offensive in any way. But I'm going to do my very best to tell the story as I understand it needs to be told. And I'm a man under authority. Not only am I married, but I am also an elder in this conference, and if I have misspoken, I am very, very happy to receive your correction. This afternoon, we're going to be moving to a phase of discussion of our movement that has come to be known as the Conservative Holiness Movement. As a bit of a recap, at the end of 1922, we have come to an era where the Methodist Church has largely disconnected with the holiness movement, the holiness message that is her heritage. Wesley says she had been raised up to spread scriptural holiness across these lands. But by 1922, and please understand that that's somewhat of an arbitrary date, there will be people after that in the Methodist Church who preach the doctrine. John R. Church, John L. Brasher, C.W. Butler, and others who were very prominent and men who preached the doctrine. There were people who experienced the doctrine. And so you may be able to take me aside at the close of this session and say, well, my grandmother was in the Methodist Church and she was sanctified holy. And I will say yes, and thank God she was. That's not a problem for me. But as of 1922 or thereabouts, I believe I can safely say that the doctrine of holiness has largely become a non-issue in the greater United Methodist Church. The National Holiness Association is an umbrella organization operating camp meetings and regional associations. We'll talk a bit more about that in a moment. The holiness movement, as I understand it, is now born as the ark upon the shoulders of four major denominations in this country: the Wesleyan Methodist Church, the Free Methodist Church, the Church of the Nazarene, and the Pilgrim Holiness Church, and those are given in the order of their chronological organization, so no deference is being shown to any one particular organization. Now, there were obviously other bodies. There was the Church of God Holiness. There was the Church of God Anderson. Someone pointed out the Salvation Army. And there were perhaps some other smaller groups. But it is my conviction that the message of holiness, as you and I understand it, was largely born into this generation on the backs and the shoulders of these four particular denominations. The burden for carrying this holiness message lay first of all with the Methodist Church. It passed to the NHA or the NACHA, and sad to say, within the last 5 years, this old organization that was known as first the National Association for the Promotion of Holiness, then came to be known as the National Holiness Association, then came to be known as the Christian Holiness Association, within the last 5 years, she has largely gone out of business. They had a periodical that has now been discontinued. They used to have yearly conventions. It is my understanding, you may correct me if I'm wrong, but they used to have conventions. I understand those have been suspended. And as of this moment, this historic organization spawned there at Vineland has now kind of gone into a tank, so to speak. It's just hardly existing at all, if in fact it is. The NHA continued to operate interdenominational camps and even sponsored missionaries while providing a reference point for the presentation of the message. Meanwhile, those organizations, we had that big long list yesterday of different groups that were spawned about 1894, different holiness groups around the country. Meanwhile, the fear of organizational structure began to wane. Many of these groups, as they came out, having felt the heavy, oppressive hand of strong central government, ran the other way to an autonomous understanding of church government, a strong emphasis upon the local church. And they did that out of reaction. They did that out of fear. But as the years began to slip away, their fear of organizational structure began to wane. People grew weary of the fragmented efforts which left overworked and underpaid staff and failed to conserve the fruit of their efforts. Gradually, the fragments began to find their way to organizations that best suited their individual needs. And we noticed yesterday that a number of them that had been independent now come back, and many of them joined the Church of the Nazarene. Some of them joined the Pilgrim Holiness Church. Much fewer of them joined the Wesleyans and the Free Methodists, and that's probably because the Nazarenes were a little more aggressive in recruiting them. And I don't say that to their shame, I just think that's a matter of history. They were a little more aggressive in recruiting these people. We have considered the organizational beginnings of each of these four, noting names and dates and places. And since it's not our assignment to deal with denominational histories, we'll not go any further. We'll just simply announce that they have appeared on the landscape. All of them have wonderful denominational histories, and if you're interested, I'd be glad to point you towards some that will help you understand what might be your particular historical background. This general statement can, however, be made, and then we'll note outstanding leaders that were committed to the doctrine and in their respective churches. In the years that followed, 1900, 1910, 20, 30, 40, in the years following the birthing of these fellowships, the primary energy was expended in developing structure, organizational polity, and an evangelistic financial base, even to the point that some of them might have been considered sectarian. There's very little interaction between these denominations. Now, I'm not saying none, but very little interaction. They have their own headquarters. They have their own denominational structure. They have their evangelists, their pastors, their churches, their mission fields, their periodicals, their camp meetings, and they live somewhat in isolation of each other. It's not to suggest that evangelism was not a priority. But when it was done in the context of their denominational settings. Do you understand? It was done in the context of their particular denominational settings. Missions and educational programs were expanded with headquarters facilities requiring attention as well. Let's notice some of the names that are related to these big four. First of all, the Wesleyan Methodist Church. We noted the name Adam Crooks, who helped to sustain the church through very, very difficult times. The name Eber Teeter. Some of you who attended Central College may remember that on the campus of Central College there was a place called Teeter Hall. Well, Teeter Hall was named for Eber Teeter, who was one of, if not, the very first president of the Alabama Conference. And that was due to the fact that we were a mission conference working from the denomination down. And so he would have been, I think if you look on the roster of conference leaders, you'll find Eber Teeter's name way toward the top. And then it would not be complete without the name Roy S. Nicholson, one of the great champions of the doctrine of holiness, and yet, as we will see in a few moments, probably associated with one of the more painful decisions that has ever been reached in the life of our church. The Free Methodist Church, Bishop Marston, Bishop Fairbairn, J. Paul Taylor. These were men of scholarship and piety who stood head and shoulders above their fellows. The Nazarenes could offer J.B. Chapman, R.T. Williams, G.B. Williamson, a whole host of evangelists like Bud Robinson, right on up to T.M. Anderson, the Corlett, Stephen White, just a host of powerful leaders who steered the ship as far as the Church of the Nazarene is concerned. The Pilgrim Holiness Church, George Culp, Wilfred Cox, R.G. Finch, Paul W. Thomas, Walter Serbrook, R.G. Flexen. These are names that would have been well known, all of them champions of the doctrine of holiness. as the 20s and the 30s were lived out, this country went through major cultural adjustments. An agricultural environment became industrial, while rural dwellers moved to the cities. Educational opportunities increased, and Western civilization became more materialistic and at the same time became more cynical. The cynicism was enhanced by two world wars, a major economic downturn known as the Great Depression, and the emergence of communism as a worldwide monolithic force. And with the increasing emphasis on the flesh and less on the spirit, the spiritual needs of mankind. Some of you remember the World War, the war years when our ladies went to the factories and our men went to war, and working on Sunday was considered a matter of national defense. During this period of time, spiritual values changed quickly. Sabbath observance, time-honored standards of modesty, the explosion of the entertainment industry through modern technology, these items all became matters for debate. All at a time when perhaps our churches were not in as good a shape as they could have been to try to sort it all out. The church found herself in the middle of this transition. And as is usually the case, the circumstances outside the church have an impact inside the church. Not always to the same degree. On the outside today, it's very, very warm. Because on the inside, if it were not for the air conditioning, perhaps the heat might not be as dramatic. It might be. Change on the outside affects what goes on in the inside. What's going on in the world affects what goes on in the church. Some of us that have raised kids know that. We don't know where they got some of this stuff. You just don't know. Suddenly, Chad comes in and he's talking about something, and I don't know where he got it. He didn't get it from our home. He didn't get it from our church. It just comes. What goes on out there affects what goes on in here. How will the holiness body, who emphasized the message of separation from the world in order that we might attain unto godliness, how would a holiness body respond to an increasingly irreligious world? Well, there were two major suggestions that seemed to work their way to the forefront. The more progressive suggested a review of previously held dogma. You see, evangelism was the priority. Anything deemed as non-essential was an unnecessary weight as the church sought to evangelize her times. Perhaps not the principles, but the application of the principles could be rethought. The world was changing. Perhaps the principles that we had held need to be reapplied. And if change was necessary, where would it come from? Who would initiate it? And to what degree would it go? And who will decide when change is enough change? Who'll decide? Obviously, the answer to this question could be extremely personal, with the possibilities that one adjustment leads to another adjustment. Matters of personal conviction and the interpretation of Bible principles, principles that contradicted contemporary living, would then be matters of review. Requirements as testimony to salvation tended to be regarded as legalism, and to be feared. On the other side, there were those who were suspicious of change in traditional understandings of righteousness and piety. Truth was eternal, and the commitment to that truth must be unrelenting. Since when did a godless society dictate to the church the minimum standards of holy living? The church had been divinely placed to be salt and light to affect the church. The church had been divinely placed to be salt and light to affect the world, not to be affected. Propositional truth was cited as opposed to the mere mention of principles. Evangelism that did not require depth of conviction and commitment was seen as shallow and ultimately inconsequential. Proponents of this position saw themselves not as legalists, but as defenders of the faith. The last days were upon us, and in those unruly times there would be those who had itching ears, who despised the truth and sought their own way. Spirituality had never been popular with the masses, but rather had always required and demanded separation from the world and conformity to eternal values. And so I hope that you see that I've tried to depict the two flows that are coming out of this generation. There may have been others, but I'm painting broad brush. But on the one hand, there were those whose hearts beat for evangelism, and they said this is a changing world, and we may need to make adjustments, particularly for entry-level Christians, although it didn't always stop there. On the other hand, there were those that said here are time-honored things that have been the characteristics of pure spiritual people through the years, and we cannot afford to let them go. If we remember that this is only the second generation for the Nazarenes and the Pilgrims who were in some ways the most aggressive promoters of the doctrine of holiness, we can understand how intense their feelings would be. The debate would surge back and forth. It was discussed in parsonages and in churches and conferences, in ministerials, wherever people gathered together who discerned the winds that were blowing. It became a matter of discussion everywhere. And as the evangelism motif seems to seize the moment, it brought changes. A greater emphasis upon the social. A greater emphasis upon worship mechanics. An identity with the people being reached as opposed to the message of separation from the world. After all, the unsaved would be unfamiliar with extemporaneous worship. All of this saying amen and shouting and running the aisles and getting blessed. This extemporaneous worship, they would not understand that. They would not understand aggressive preaching. And they would not understand the ascetic practices of piety. The church life of the mainline holiness congregations began to take on a commonality with their non-holiness brothers in the broader evangelical world. In the late 1940s, some of the holiness groups joined the National Association of Evangelicals, and respectability became a watchword. Those who championed the distinctives of the years gone by were deeply troubled. Words such as compromise and worldliness were frequently on the lips of troubled observers. And as they struggled with what they saw, they began to react. Some would say they reacted to the symptoms and not the disease. I won't make that call, some said it. But certainly the pulpit began to cry out against such things as church kitchens, as they saw the encroachment of what they perceived to be a social emphasis above a spiritual. The emerging television, which was seen as a private substitute for the long-abhorred theater. Fashion reflections, such as jewelry, short hair for women. Pulpit began to cry out in these areas. The offended constituency looked on with horror as these practices became norms in denominational educational centers, and pastors' wives took on the marks of the world. The preaching of holiness as a second work of grace was now joined with a strong ethical association. And if you have read Wally Thornton's book, you have followed that in detail. But that is a very critical point in the life of our movement. As these changes begin to take place, the preaching of holiness came to be associated with a strong ethical emphasis. So that as I move forward, somebody's going to say, well, why don't you just talk about the doctrine of holiness? As it was known in the conservative, as it came to be known in the conservative holiness movement, you got them both with the package. Equally lamented with the past was the passing of the emphasis on prayer, fasting, and emotional enjoyments of religion. The contrast was becoming quite clear. And the roads being traveled more diverse, even as they attended the same church camps, conferences, and conventions. Polarization drove the two sides apart just as surely as the Methodist Church parted company with the holiness crowd 50 years before. Since holiness, the doctrine of holiness, was a point of commonality between the two groups, for both of them would have preached textbook theological second work of grace. Since the term holiness was a sense of point of commonality between the two, new terms were adopted to identify the dichotomy. Terms like old-fashioned, radical, and conservative were employed to establish the contrast. Do you follow me? Do you see where I'm going? As the years slipped away, the two had less and less interaction and more suspicion. The concerns we have highlighted in a general way can be spelled out specifically in respective denominations. And in so doing, we do not depreciate persons named or suggest that all who were members of these organizations were backslidden compromisers. There are, however, some changes that can be documented. And I probably need to catch up with myself here. Okay, we've looked at general evangelism versus understood values. And now I want to look specifically at these four major denominations and the changes that came. Because only then can we begin to understand why we as a people are here. The Wesleyan Methodist Church, in the 1952 General Conference, and I apologize for reading, but I want to be specific. I don't want to freelance my way through this. 1952 General Conference, President Roy Nicholson had ruled that the wedding ring was not a test of membership. His ruling was in response to an Ohio Conference resolution decreeing that no one should be received into membership until he had left off the wearing of gold, including the wedding ring. The decision of the conference was appealed, and President Nicholson ruled in favor of the appeal. Later in the decade, the Tennessee Conference had approved legislation declaring that no minister or delegate would be elected to office who had a television who was in favor of it, and they asked their local churches to take the same stand. President Nicholson had ruled this legislation null and void and was sustained by the General Conference of 1959 on a vote of 132-22. Tennessee Conference proceeded to try a prominent church on violating the television requirement. They appealed that ruling, and it also was sustained by President Nicholson. And the conference responded by withdrawing funds from denominational programs and establishing a lectern off-platform for those to speak from who did not support the conference position. The Allegheny Conference, second largest in the denomination and one of the six original conferences, amended its corporate charter, omitting any reference to the Wesleyan Methodist Connection of America, but the Wesleyan Methodist Church of America, because in the late 40s the term connection had been dropped. Ministers within the conference appealed this action to the general level, and they were sustained. These were but a few of the public acts. But everywhere change was in the air and people were talking. And it's easy to see that not only was there a reaction to the fact that their values were not being appreciated, but there was a reaction to the fact that the strong central government had been the vehicle that had suppressed the values that they held. Let's move to the Free Methodist Church. I'm not as familiar with the Free Methodist Church, and so I asked for help. And my good friend Larry Smith sent me some notes that I will take the liberty to present to you. Larry writes, in a sense, the Free Methodist Church was the first specific holiness denomination in America, and its Wesleyan witness had been pronounced and durable. But by the turn of the 20th century, it was increasingly affected by the dramatic changes which were to alter the face of the entire movement. Many believe that an early symptom of spiritual decline was the General Conference's removal of the historical ban on instrumental music in 1943. Even conservatives who were not opposed to the use of the Wooten Brother realized that many were wishing to relax the church's historic disciplines of personal piety, and that behind the music question was more modernization and liberalization. In 1951, for the Wesleyan Church it was 1952, in 1951, the General Conference deleted the historic footnote in the discipline which applied the rule against the wearing of gold to those wearing gold wedding rings. This was a symptom of a general reaction against the earlier emphasis on plainness and frugality of dress, but it was also a major boost to the reaction. And in the wake of the 1951 action, there came a torrent of worldliness in dress. At the same time, there were other behavioral issues which caused increasing concern. Sabbath breaking, the wearing of shorts, women with short hair, movies, etc. became muted, especially on the coast. Doctrinal matters also are a part of the confusion. For instance, he says, I remember the protests at our conference when it became known that a president of a Free Methodist college in our area considered himself as an underground agent against the doctrine of entire sanctification, but was given a position in another college. Conservatives raised a valiant cry against these alterations in basic Free Methodist identity, and some in larger conferences such as Oil City in East Michigan and in smaller conferences such as Nebraska and Wyoming, those were the protests were. There were persons of stature in the church who realized the peril. Bishop Ormston told his father, then a conference superintendent, that the Free Methodist Church was through as a spiritual force, and Bishop Marston warned that the church was at a crossroads and in peril. The Nazarene Church. The Church of the Nazarene had felt these struggles from the very beginning. At that meeting in Pilot Point, where the Western group and the Eastern group had joined with the Southern group, there had been a great deal of division. The Southern group was much stronger on the matter of external standards than the other two had been. The issue of the wedding ring and the matter of the lodge had all been matters for discussion, as well as other outward standards. And when that discussion was going on, there came the point where one of the Nazarene ministers said, "Hey, look, if they want this, let's just call it off." And Dr. Brzee said, "We can't call it off. They are one of our own." And so adjustments were made. And it would have appeared for a little while as though the issues had been settled in the Church of the Nazarene. I have a quotation here from Dr. Chapman, but I believe I'll just pass over that. But the issues of, well, maybe I shouldn't. I can find it here. Listen carefully. What is the state and tendency of your church and community? And he began, do people wear, then he mentions different things, jewelry, short hair, profess holiness, sing in the choir, belong to the church? If they do, someone has held his peace too much and too long. One cannot very well feel that he is an all-time holiness church when these things are taking a leading part in the singing and other performances of the church building. Let our pastors preach and our people practice the general rules of the Church of the Nazarene, and may God save us from the faith that has overtaken many such movements as have gone before us and which wrecked on those reefs of conformity to the world. Others were not so sure that the issues had been settled. W.H. Johnson and Nazarene D.S. in Arkansas contended, while there had always been differences among the Nazarenes on specific standards due to mergers, that the general tenor had always been conservative, but that the emphasis had changed from better men to better trained men, from better programs to better programs in place of deeper passion, building a great denomination instead of an evangelistic movement. But the inherent conflict was not long in coming. Apparently in the early 1940s, there were district superintendents of the Church of the Nazarene who refused to recommend to their churches pastors who were involved with the wedding ring. And despite two rulings of the general superintendents that the plain band did not constitute the wearing of gold. The use of makeup by women was also widely condemned, along with short hair, short skirts, short sleeves. The wearing of slacks was also opposed. And at this strategic point, seeking to find balance, we begin to hear voices that we will perhaps hear again. R.T. Williams was general superintendent of considerable clout. In 1940, he had written a quadrennial address in which he addressed the issue of legalism. That word always comes up. It always comes up. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Dr. Williams says legalism is the enemy to be feared. Legalism gives more attention to law than it does to human beings. In other words, it's law without love. No church can survive unless it fulfills the law of love, both in experience and practice. The Church of the Nazarene operates under grace backed by law. Legalism would draw us away from grace and put the entire emphasis of the ministry and of the ethics upon the matter of law without mercy and without love. This is a danger ever to be guarded against by the church. And there's just enough truth in that statement that it cannot be totally discarded. And there's just enough risk in that statement that we could lose our way. Later in the January meeting, Williams spoke specifically to the issue of district leaders setting extreme standards for membership on their districts. Such action, he says, tends to make the leader in question feel his district is more spiritual. 1942, H.H. Wise, pastor of First Nazarene in Nashville, wrote to his general superintendent complaining about those who preached against certain issues. In 1952, when the television issue began to come to the front, General Superintendent G.B. Williamson published a front-page article in the Herald of Holiness entitled "The Errors of Eccentric Emphasis." Giving too much attention to things on the surface, he says, creates superficial lives. We must be content with the preaching of the Word of God with proper pressure on things central and fundamental. This will keep all in balance. Everything will receive attention in proportion to its importance. The Word of God will mightily grow and prevail. Now, interestingly, Williamson's re-election margin dropped from 96% to 88%. Two memorials banning the viewing of television were rejected by the committee responsible, one by a vote of 58-24. A substitute was offered instead, which read as follows. It acknowledged the great moral confusion which could result through the encroachment of the evils of the day into the sacred precincts of the home through some media such as current literature, radio, and television. Careful safeguards must be established to keep the home from becoming secularized and worldly. While recognizing evangelism opportunities in media presentation, they expressed concern over the moral tone and the sensuous appeal of modern literature, comic magazines, and media presentations. Nazarene leaders urged caution and principles of discrimination. Much concern was expressed for the Lord's Day, when no television program should ever be permitted to become a substitute for church attendance. And this admonitory package was passed by the committee by a vote of 73-12. But it was obvious that not everybody was happy. In 1953, editor Stephen White wrote about those who were proud of their own plainness and the worldliness of those who criticize others. G.B. Williamson would write of those who cover spiritual poverty with the whitewash of Phariseeism. Clearly, the stage is set for conflict. Pilgrim Holiness Church. The Pilgrim Holiness Church probably was more decidedly conservative in tone than was her Nazarene colleagues, but they didn't escape the problem. 1938, a memorial was brought before the General Assembly which proposed that the church membership covenant be amended to forbid the wearing of wedding rings by members. It was tabled after considerable debate. In 1950, a memorial opposing the wearing of all rings was proposed for the special rules section of the discipline. It carried by a vote of 285-17, pretty strong vote in the Pilgrim Church in favor of making denying the rights for the wedding ring. But the chairman of the assembly ruled that the approved legislation was to be admonitory only. And again, through organizational technique, the conservative people were thwarted. An attempt, in this next paragraph is very significant, because there were people in those years who said, why doesn't the general church just allow particular conferences to be what they want to be islands within islands? Ninth, an attempt by conservatives in New York to exercise autonomous authority in their own district. They tried that. It was ruled to be in conflict with the General Conference Resolution of 1954 to deny to any district or local church the right to impose rules which are contrary to the manual, and requested that any district which had made such in its minutes would delete them. Again, the issues were first outward standards, wedding ring, television, and in this case, divorce and remarriage. Second, central government, which imposed an offending point of view. In summary, from the general statements of the outset to the specific examples offered, you are asked to observe the flow of events. From the denominational leader point of view, there was a national church to sustain, and the majority had ruled. And I read the numbers to you a moment ago. It wasn't close, particularly in the Wesleyan Church. It wasn't close. The denominational leader's point of view, there was a national church to defend and the majority ruled. There could be no islands. Spirituality was to be the guard and admonition the tool to implement church discipline. Those who sought stricter measures were insubordinate and potentially dangerous as radicals, distorting the simplicity of the gospel. The dissenter's point of view, the church has forsaken her heritage. Frequent testimony would be, I've not left the church has left me. Spirituality and revival were out of the question, they thought, where leaders and churches pursued pleasure in the world in the place of spiritual disciplines. To oppose the advance of legislation, a holy war began to be fought with ballots, denial of funds, and confrontation. The kingdom of God required men of courage and conviction in the face of a sellout. Wesleyan Methodist pastor in Rochester, Pennsylvania, a man by the name of Harold Smuel, presented for all to understand the issues as he understood them. He said there was an overemphasis upon education and scholasticism, upon ecclesiastical law and power, upon personalities and human ability, programs, machinery, and church bureaucracy. numbers, statistics, finances, consecration or rededication, recreational and social activities, church or denominational loyalty, positive preaching, religious movies, dangers of emotionalism and excitement. He said there was an under-emphasis upon prayer and fasting, missions and lost souls, spirituality of the Scriptures, confession, humility, restitution, doctrine of holiness, Bible repentance, spiritual leadership. And Brother Spiel said there was no emphasis at all on the part of those who he was opposing on the matter of worldliness and worldly adornment, parliamentary privileges of minorities, significance of church membership, the need of negative preaching, dangers of compromise and drifting, liberty in the Holy Spirit. The stage had been set. A Wesleyan pastor wrote the following article, and I read it at length, and I will identify the author when I have finished. "Choose you this day, a message to the holiness people. Men who would go with God must make a choice. It has ever been so, and today we face it very definitely. We are constantly coming to the dividing of the ways. There is the choice one must make between the broad way and the narrow way. And then one must choose between the world and the church. And when one is once inside the pale of the professing Christianity, there is a choice between modernism and fundamentalism. And within the ranks of fundamentalism, there lie the two paths of Calvinism and Wesleyanism. And strange though it may be, there is still a choice to be made therein within the holiness movement. Even there, the soul is confronted by two ways, two definite groups, two emphases, two schools of thought. The lines are being sharply and clearly drawn. Choose we must. Neutrality is impossible. These two groups or ways are sometimes termed, on the one hand, the old-fashioned radical group, and on the other hand, the popular liberal group. There are those who would have us believe that actually the only difference between these two elements is some disagreements over so-called minor non-essentials, such as dress and outward conformity. But careful thought and observation leads us to an entirely opposite conclusion. The differences are basic and vital. There are actually two different groups and not merely a few divergences of taste and outward appearance. There are certain irreconcilable fundamental differences between which there can be no compromise. Try to alter one, transforms it into the other. And to veer from one way is to walk in the other. The differences are identifying as to which group one really belongs and which way one is taking. We are in spirit aligned with one or the other, regardless of profession or actual contact and fellowship. What is meant is not an individual or blanket indictment of those who may differ from my viewpoint, but it is the honest result of my experience, observation, and reflection." And he said, may I hasten to add that there are some good people and some not so good in both groups. There are also wrong attitudes and wrong spirits manifested on both sides. Neither way is to be judged by the fruits of some of its adherents any more than Christianity is to be judged by the sins of some professing it. To make a correct estimate of each way and thereby arrive at a choice, we must see the vital issues from which the differences arise, observe the basic trends of each way, and conclude the probable end to be reached by each. Let me set forth briefly some of the areas of difference without stating which group is on which side, and let you be the judge as to the category with which each falls. The first area of difference we note is that of preaching. On the one hand, there is a shying from specifics and preaching against sin and worldliness and a substitution of pale generalities which leave sin and carnality covered and undisturbed. There is little sympathy for or toleration of preaching which might expose anyone in official position in the churches. Naturally, the other group emphasizes such preaching. Two, Christian experience. Here one group places emphasis upon genuine repentance that involves confession of sin and restitution and real praying through to a definite witness of the Spirit. And on the other side, there is a real tendency to adopt the approach of accepting Christ and a shallow taken by faith, reasoning people into salvation. There is apparently no discernment when people need to confess and break with sin. Both fail to deal with the basic need of human soul and the merely daubing with untoward temper. well, in tempered mortar. The same line is followed in dealing with seekers for holiness that are not many marks of a deep death to self and sin. Three, he says, church promotion and services. Four, he talks about Christian ethics. One group stands against such practices, attendance at movies, public sporting events, public or mixed baiting. Television is also recognized as a form of evil to be kept from the homes. There is a trend, to put it mild, in the other group to more and more accept all of these proper conduct for Christians, even professors of the experience of holiness. Having noted some of these basic differences, which are clearly discernible in the church's revivals, camps, and conventions of the two groups, and thereby recognizing the two ways within the holiness movement, let's now ask ourselves the question as to the direction each is tending to go. After all, the direction to which anything is going and to what and where it may eventually lead is of prime importance. Which of these ways, groups, or teachings would tend to lead the groups into the rocks of worldliness that have wrecked so many churches and movements? Is there no danger today from the world against which Jesus and the writers of the Bible spoke so definitely? Do you see any trend toward the world in either of these ways? If so, in which is the greater danger? It seems to me that it is much safer to go along with that which is headed in the right direction, even though it may be a bit rugged and imperfect, than to follow that which appears smoother but would lead astray in the end. Which group would come nearer to accepting a watered-down doctrine of holiness? What will be the end, may I ask? May I ask if you ever knew of a church going modernistic by being too strict and narrow? On the other hand, did you ever hear of one backsliding and apostatizing by first letting down on standards of conduct and then on doctrine? Furthermore, did you ever know of anyone dying victoriously, triumphantly, and gloriously, saying, I'm glad I never sought and professed holiness, I'm happy I fought holiness? Or did you ever know of one to say, I'm glad that I'm not too separated from the world, I'm glad I took the popular way? No, friend, when cold sweat lies on your brow, when the earth is growing dim and eternity looming near, no man is too narrow then, no man is too separate then. God help us to choose the way, though straight and narrow, that involves no risk of arriving at the wrong destination. I'll take the narrow way. With a resolute few who dare to go through, I'll take the narrow way. So wrote S.D. Herron, pastor of the Wesleyan Church in Knoxville, Tennessee at the time. As the conflict seethed in the early 50s, dissidents in varying groups became aware that the problems they were confronting were not unique to them. Remember, I said that these denominations operated somewhat isolated from each other. But as the problems began to grow, they became aware that, just vaguely aware, that they were not alone. Voices from the outside world brought news of similar conflicts being waged by people with common mind in other sections. Strength and support could be found in joining in times of renewal and refreshment. The need for such a mechanism was no doubt discussed by many. The idea of such a vehicle for the association was first given shape by two veteran Wesleyan Methodist ministers. In June of 1951, the Reverend Harold Smule suggested a convention. He took his idea to H. Rob French, R. G. Flexen, and H. C. Van Warmer. They felt a need for some kind of general meeting to encourage the old-fashioned crowd to hold their convictions against the drift of the world. The first assembly was held on December the 31st. It lasted through January the 1st, 1951-52, in Salem, Ohio. There's the background, the origin, the first convention. The persons were Brother Smule, Flexen, Van Warmer, H.R. French, J.R. Mitchell. And that's not a good picture. But that's the picture of the church where the very first convention was held. Now, if any of you are familiar with Salem, Ohio, were you guys there? Okay, that's the church he attended. I don't suppose there would be anybody here that was there. If so, I would be happy for you to raise your hand. If you know anything about Salem, Ohio, and where Salem Bible College is, Allegheny Wesleyan College, if you go south out of Salem, correct me, Brother Parker, if I'm wrong, if you go south out of Salem, it's on the right hand, would be Ellsworth, I believe. You go south on Ellsworth, and it's on the right-hand side of the road. It still stands there. I hope it'll stand there for a long, long time. The only thing is I wish we'd put some kind of markings there to help to appreciate what it is. But the site of the first Interchurch Holiness Convention was held there in the Emmanuel Wesley Church, 1951. And the principal persons were Brother Harold Smuel, who always called himself the chore boy of the organization. Brother Smuel was my pastor for a while, and heard him preach many, many times, as I know many of you have heard him preach many times. Also in attendance was H. Rob French. Brother French actually was some distance away. And so the story goes, he got a bus ticket to get to that convention, and the bus was full, and so he stood up on that bus. The story was he stood up on that bus all the way from where he was to Salem to be there for this very first IH convention. Another very familiar face, that's an older picture, John, I don't know how old that would be, but that's R.G. Flexen. How many of you heard Flexen preach? All right, that's good. How many of you heard French preach? Great, there's good. And how many of you heard Smuel preach? Okay, we're not a dying lot just yet. We're still alive. This guy right here, I heard him as a little boy at Fairmount Camp in Indiana. He had absolutely the sternest illustrations I ever heard in my life. He could scare me with an inch of my life. But these were the men that were there, in addition to a host of others. Maybe we could name some others. H.C. Van Warmer, for Allegheny people that are here, I apologize. I wanted the picture, and I simply could not find one in order to put it up. S.I. Emery, L.D. Wilcox, Eldon Martin, S.D. Heron, the list goes on and on of people that were very, very important in these early beginnings. J.R. Mitchell wrote of the early conventions, "The ministry has been that of both inspiration and warning. With prophetic insight, God's seers have pointed out the dangers before us, the current drift toward lukewarmness and worldliness, and the subtle invasion of the home by modern inventions that break down its sanctity. The tendency of the church to borrow the methods of the world under the plea of expediency. All these have been pointed out as danger spots in the mid-20th century. A clear call has been issued to prayer, simplicity, modesty, and holy living." Now, the first meeting was a success. It reminds me very, very, as a matter of fact, I tried earlier, I don't know if you made the connections or not, but there's a strong association in my mind between the emergence of the National Holiness Association and now the emergence of the Interchurch Holiness Convention. There's a lot of similarities. The Vineland Camp was successful. The first convention at Salem was successful. And so they would need to, they grew and they needed to move, and they moved to Vine Street Wesleyan Methodist Church in Cincinnati. Who's been there? All right, there's a few. I have not been there. For those of you from that Hope Sound ties, I understand that Brother and Sister Zook, who were the founder, along with the Frenches that were the founders at Hope Sound, he was the pastor of the church, Vine Street Wesleyan Methodist Church at the time. The meeting outgrew the church, and the auditorium of God's Bible School was utilized. And how appropriate that this center 50 years prior for the proclamation of a message unpalatable to the Methodist Church would in those short years become the center of a renewal message for the Methodist come-outers. Now this meeting, this IH convention, was naturally viewed with suspicion by general church leaders. The truth is that it never did become the denomination that they feared that it would be, just as the NHA hadn't. The truth is also that it became a point of reference for those who were troubled, discouraged, and discontented. And I ask your indulgence at this point, for it's as only yesterday. My father was pastor of a Wesleyan Methodist church on the Indiana Conference. I was just a little guy, but I was smart enough to know that there weren't more than 6 churches that my daddy could pastor out of 120 on that district. Such were the changes. I remember being there when the first pastor and his wife were ordained with the wedding ring. I remember being there when the first television set came into parsonages on that district. And I remember my daddy saying, "I'm going to go to this convention. It's a way off down in Cincinnati." We lived in Richmond, Indiana at the time. "It's a way off down in Cincinnati. I'm going to go to this convention." And daddy was gone for two or three days. I'll never forget when he came home. For days, he talked about him. And my little mind and heart and life was blessed for the first time with the names of Griffith, Herod, and Yoakum, and Shmuel. They became household names in our house. My son will accuse me of being melodramatic, but I'll just tell you, they became heroes in our house. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. When you find people that espouse your values and can emulate the truth that you have come to understand as God's truth, it doesn't hurt for you to have your children associate with those kind of people. They have feet of clay, I am sure, but better that they identify with them than some of the heroes that are going to move into that vacuum if we don't fill it. Now, I am lecturing on church history just in case you feel like I've lapsed into something else. They were our heroes. I will never forget it. And then the day came when I had the privilege to meet them. And I felt like I was among the greats. And now I'm 57. And I look back and I read the history and I know that some of them had feet of clay. And now I'm wise enough to read the history and know that perhaps some mistakes were made. And but you know what? I've made some too. And so will you. So will you. So towering over the landscape of my past are the memories of the raspy voice of Glenn Griffith, the academic sonoric sounds of Dale Yoakum, the athletic pose of a Rob French with that Bible in his right hand folded over either side and that left hand forcing the air as he emphasized the matter of prayer and revival. The shallow, whispery voice of S.D. Herring. The seraphic, oratorical skills of a Harold Smule. Can I just testify? They set a direction in my life. They set a direction in my life. And I don't say that to try to generate it. I just tell you the truth. It set the direction of my life. Say, folks, you're going somewhere. You're going to make a decision based on something. Somebody's going to set the course of your life. Somebody's going to set the values for your children. I remember Daddy coming home for days. We used to joke about it. We said that for Daddy, the Holy Trinity was Stoneboro, Van Warmer, and Allegheny. We were looking for a church to go to and couldn't find one. And Daddy said, we can always go to Allegheny. Some of you know Charles Martin. There was one church left in the Allegheny Conference, Bluefield, West Virginia. Brother Van Warmer said to my dad, said, you can have, Charles, I've got to offer that church to him. If he wants that church, he can go there. If for whatever reason he chooses not to go there, it could be yours. Brother Martin took it. We moved to Tennessee. I could have been an Allegheny person. I moved to Tennessee. Brother Herring was a member of that conference, and the rest of it is history. But those men became my heroes. Here at this convention, they shared their concerns. Here they encouraged one another in their common struggle. Here they were refreshed, invigorated, and empowered. The General Yearly Convention was followed by district or area conventions where speakers came for only expenses to encourage and challenge. I'm not finding fault, but I do get just a little amused sometimes when I see the schedule of the IEC come out now. Because back in the old years, you didn't know you were going to preach when you went there. Now, some of those guys were sharp enough to know they might be used, but Brother Denton was a very good friend of mine, and I've listened to him. He'd be over there down on his knees at maybe the Wednesday prayer meeting. The Spiel would come by, tap him on the shoulder, say, you're on for Bible study in the morning. That's the way they, I'm not saying it's the way to do it. I'm just saying that's the way they did it. This provided for an interchange of personalities and ideas which strengthened resolve. Our Wesleyan people would never have heard some of the Pilgrim people. Dale Yoakum would never have made it into my world. Glenn Griffith would never have come to my world. had it not been for the agency of the convention who provided a platform for the interchange of personalities and the interchange of ideas and fellowship where people commiserated. You know, the devil likes for you to think you're all by yourself and he can handle you all by yourself. But as you find common strength from each other, and I'm not talking about a bunch of whiners and complainers. I'm talking about people who have burdens and concerns and values as they came together. Provided an interchange for them, and as in the case of the NHA, it provided a new frame of reference for social, spiritual, and cultural issues. The IHC became a wheel within many wheels, wittingly or unwittingly, pollinating the whole holiness movement. As the holiness crowd moved toward another round of course corrections or adjustments. And those adjustments would begin in 1955 when the Bible Missionary Church left the Church of the Nazarene. And those adjustments continued through at least 1968. And those are the items that we want to look at in the sessions tomorrow. Again, it is not my intention to be offensive in any way, but who we are as Bible Methodist people is forged and formed out of the discussion which I've just endeavored to lay before you. If you have complaints with the way I've done it, bring them to me. I prefer to hear them from you and not your friend. Okay? Is that fair? If I've not been faithful to the reality of it, I'll be glad for you to talk to me. Those were turbulent times. Those were difficult times. If you lived through them, you know they were difficult times. And I'm not here to standing here to say that everything was done perfectly on either side of the table. But I'm satisfied of this. There were people of conviction who set a course that you and I have inherited today. And may God help us to be faithful to the trust that has been imparted. Let's stand together, please.